This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to Crimes and Consequences. I have a phenomenal true crime story to tell you guys today.
Oh, I can't wait.
Most of the time I do a story, it's because I'm really interested in learning about a crime that I don't know much about. And this is one of those cases. This is about the infamous Cleveland Strangler. I'd heard him on the news, and I didn't know much about his crimes, but I do now. And it's so shocking.
What is it on the gruesome scale?
It's not all that high on the gruesome scale, but it's really high on the interesting scale.
Awesome.
And it's kind of nasty.
So it's kind of gruesome?
So if there's a nasty scale.
It's a 10 on the nasty scale.
Do you know much about him?
No.
Well, then let me tell you.
Yeah, let's hear it. Quit wasting all this time. Let's do it.
Sorry. On a cool October morning in Cleveland, Ohio in 2009, 51-year-old Shawn Morris started coming to her senses. What the hell was she thinking, smoking crack in the house of a man she'd met only hours earlier? Shawn should have been home with her husband, Doug, helping him get the kids ready for school. For the past 18 years, Doug had supported her through her ups and downs of the crack addiction that had consumed her life. But she knew he was going to be pissed at her this time. She had left her home the night before to walk to a Bible study session.
Oh, girl, where did you go wrong?
Well, she would often go to a Bible study session when she had urges to smoke crack. But when she went that night, the session had been canceled.
Oh, damn it.
On her way home, she bumped into a girlfriend named Nini, who convinced her to have a few beers. Being an addict, once Shawn started boozing, because she was also addicted to alcohol, she couldn't stop. After binging all night, she ran into a man named Tony, and he asked her if she wanted to smoke some crack with him. With her inhibitions lowered and her cravings high, Shawn agreed to walk to his home to keep the partying going. She didn't want to go home and face the consequences of her husband, whom she knew was going to bitch at her. By 9 a.m. in the morning, after 2 hours of smoking crack and drinking with her host, Shawn decided it was time to leave and face the inevitable argument waiting for her at home. As she was leaving Tony's three-story house on Imperial Avenue, which at the time was known as a place frequented by drug dealers and plagued by violence, she realized she forgot her ID. The house was a duplex, so she knocked on one of the two front doors and Tony let her in. As she was making her way to the second level apartment where they'd been partying, she just couldn't get over the nasty stench that filled the air. Even the incense Tony had been burning earlier couldn't mask the smell. She assumed it was a dead animal or animal feces from a pet hiding somewhere. Or perhaps the smell was emanating from the sausage company next door. As she climbed to the top of the second level steps, Tony suddenly wrapped his arms around her neck in a military chokehold and whispered in her ear, "You aren't leaving here, and you will answer all of my questions and demands with a yes, sir."
Uh-oh.
He told her, "If you try to run or scream, I'll kill you." Shawn was dragged into the apartment, made to strip of her clothes, pushed on a bed face down, and brutally raped for hours. Tony cranked up the music from the sound system to drown out her screams. During the rape and the beatings, because he beat her, Tony repeatedly called her a bitch, commenting on how much he hated crack smoking bitches. It seemed like the assault would never end, but then, briefly, Tony got up to shut one of the bedroom windows, and Sean saw her chance to escape. Still naked, she kicked out the screen from a different second-story bedroom window and tried to slide out of it while holding onto the sill. Below her 20 feet was an old broken-up pavement, almost like a sidewalk, that had tall weeds growing between the cracks. The paved area separated Tony's home from Ray's Sausage Company. The area between the two buildings resembled a small alleyway of sorts, and a chain-link fence blocked anyone from entering the space. So you have Tony's house. In between is a fence, and then on the other side is a sausage company.
They are that close?
They're that close.
Wow.
I bet you there's only 8 feet in between.
Wow.
All the houses on Imperial Avenue were very close to each other. As Sean prepared herself for the hard drop on the concrete below, Tony grabbed her by the wrist and he tried to pull her back up, breaking her wrist and a few fingers in doing so. Sean's 175-pound body weight proved to be too heavy for this 6-foot-tall, 155-pound man. Since Tony couldn't pull Sean up, he chose to push her down. With all his force, he pushed Sean on the shoulders, causing her to fall 20 feet onto the cold pavement. The fall fractured her skull and broke 8 of her ribs. She lay there naked, bleeding, and moaning in pain, unable to move. The neighborhood, as I described earlier, was filled with other houses tightly spaced together, and it was bustling with people. Onlookers started gathering around the chain link fence, peering at Sean through it. Donald Laster, who owned some rental houses on Imperial Avenue, he was driving behind his Escalade when he noticed the commotion. He pulled over to the side of the road and he walked up to the fence line. He was pissed to see some of these gawkers were taking videos and pictures of Sean with their phone instead of calling for help.
Oh, that's tacky.
But he was even more surprised when he saw a naked man bear crawling on the pavement headed towards Sean.
He's naked too?
Yeah, Tony's naked. Tony reached the bleeding woman and he crouched over, naked. And it appeared from the distance that he was choking her. A neighbor yelled out, "What you doing, Tony?" And Tony responded, "Are you ready for this? It's cool. She's my wife. We were fucking and she fell out the window." That's a quote.
What were they on the windowsill?
I guess that's the story he wants people to believe. You just, you know, fucking your wife on the windowsill and she fell out. And she fell out.
Okay. I guess stranger things have happened.
It's true. In some of our episodes.
Yes. But I don't think I would believe that.
The man yelled back, "It's not cool. She's bleeding." Ignoring him, Tony started dragging Sean along the concrete towards the back of the house, ripping the skin off her legs as he went. Donald demanded he put Sean down immediately or he was going to jump over the fence and kick Tony's ass. And Donald could. He was a large man. Tony, realizing Donald meant it, dropped Sean and she smacked down onto the cement. Not really understanding what was going on, Donald called 911 and requested an ambulance, but he didn't request the police. And a lot of people in the area weren't fond of the police.
They probably tried to avoid the police.
Yeah. The EMT arrived to the scene within 5 minutes. When they got there, Tony had helped Sean to her feet and was trying to get her to walk into his house. The EMT crew insisted he stop and placed Sean in the back of the ambulance. They drove her to the nearest hospital where she was treated for a broken wrist, 3 broken fingers, and 8 broken ribs. In addition, as a result of the fall, Sean suffered an aneurysm and had to have emergency brain surgery. Skin grafts had to be performed on her legs.
Oh my God.
To the doctor's surprise, Sean pulled through and regained consciousness 3 days later. One of the first things she mentioned to a treating nurse was that she needed to call her husband immediately because he had to be worried sick, wondering where she'd been for the last 3 days. But the nurse assured her she didn't have to worry about that because her husband had rode with her in the ambulance to the hospital.
Oh, no.
Unbelievably, they let Tony ride with her. Isn't that crazy?
It is.
Sean laid on the hospital bed in disbelief. Then, almost immediately, her hospital phone rang. When she answered it, she recognized the voice. It was Tony. He told her she better not tell the police the truth of what happened, or he would kill her. Sean was terrified. Believing Tony would follow through with his threats, she called her husband Doug and lied, telling him she'd been hit by a car while she was crossing the street. Now, hospital personnel were concerned that Sean might be a victim of domestic violence, so they reported the incident to the police.
Uh-oh.
They were like you. They didn't really believe the whole lot fell out the window while I was fucking.
Yeah, no.
However, when the police questioned Sean, she lied to them too. She claimed she fell off the roof on the second level while trying to get her keys.
Her keys were on the roof?
I guess. And keep in mind, she's naked.
Right.
None of the investigators were buying her story, so they followed up with Tony. As they approached the Imperial Avenue home where he lived, the officers couldn't help but notice the smell of rotting flesh permeating the area. They, too, dismissed it as being from Ray's sausage company next door.
Well, some nasty-ass sausage, if that's the truth. Who's eating that?
Everyone, Tanya, including the Cleveland Health Department, thought the horrible stench of death came from the meatpacking building. In fact, after receiving numerous complaints, the health department sent an agent to inspect the company. They started receiving the complaints in the spring of 2007, and this is the fall of 2009.
Oh my God.
The inspector couldn't locate the source of the smell, but basically ordered Ray's Sausage Company to make upgrades such as new piping and a new sewer system, which ended up costing them over $20,000. But nothing helped the toxic scent that was all over the neighborhood. And the owners of Ray's Sausage were pissed. They argued in 57 years, they'd never once had any complaints. And they said, we don't even slaughter animals here. We just get frozen meat, turn it into sausage, and deliver it to the stores. At Tony's home, the police questioned him about the incident with Sean. He basically said the same story as Sean, saying it was an accident. And the police didn't believe him, but if Sean's not going to cooperate, then there's nothing that they can do about it. After 8 days, Sean was released from the hospital and Tony was free to continue unleashing his sadistic rage on more victims. However, his time was running out. In 10 days, the police would unearth the cause of the smell that had been festering the Imperial Avenue neighborhood for 2 years. And when they do, let me tell you, it's not pretty.
Oh, we can't wait to hear.
Sean wasn't the only victim to survive Tony's brutality. A month earlier, 36-year-old LaTundra, she went by Lala, Phillips, was admitted to the University Hospital with a brutal tale of rape and attempted murder. Not only did she have the injuries to back up her story, but she was more than willing to tell the police everything that happened to her. Lala had met 50-year-old Anthony so well, a.k.a. Tony, 2 years prior when he was living with his ex-girlfriend, Lori Frazier, Lala's longtime friend. Although Lori and Tony had broken up, Lala continued to go to Tony's house to drink and smoke crack with him. She hadn't always been a crackhead. This self-described military brat grew up in a stable environment where hard work and education were instilled in her. She excelled in school and even graduated at the age of 16.
Wow.
I know.
Impressive.
But she was very shy. And in her teen years, she tried alcohol and realized it made her more social. Then she started smoking weed. unbeknownst to her, someone had handed her a marijuana joint laced with crack. And from there, her life just fell apart. It was September 23rd in 2009 when Lala bumped into Tony while walking home from a friend's house. He invited her over to have a drink and smoke crack. Lala had heard rumors around the neighborhood that Tony had been abusing women. In fact, one woman claimed he held her hostage for a day, raping and beating her the entire time. But the urge to smoke crack was too powerful for Lala to resist, and she followed Tony to his house, like a lamb to the slaughter. He led her to the second floor of the three-level house he'd been living in since 2005. Although there were only two doors on the outside, like a duplex, it was actually a triplex, originally owned by Tony's stepmother. But when she got placed in a nursing home, Tony ended up with the entire house to himself. So there's three different living levels there. Lala had never been on the second floor before. In all the years she'd known Tony, he'd always partied on the third floor apartment, which was where he basically lived. But he told her that it was too messy and not fit for company. Let me tell you, that's an understatement. He led her down a hallway, past a living room that only had a plastic chair for furnishing, and into a small bedroom. All the blinds were closed and a tattered blanket lay on the floor with an extension cord next to it. That was all that was in the room.
That is really creepy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like,
why are we in this bare-ass room?
With an extension cord with nothing plugged in it?
Mm-hmm.
Although the surroundings made Lala uneasy, her cravings for crack quickly chased away any of her fear. The two sat next to each other on this gross blanket and began passing around the crack pipe. Tony was drinking some King Cobra malt liquor, and Lala was sipping on some Wild Irish Rose. Nasty as shit. I have experienced it many a time in my youth. That shit's gross. But I'm not faulting her because, as I just said, I've drank the hell out of it before too. After getting a buzz, Tony's dark side emerged. He grabbed at Lala's breast in a half-kidding manner, then punched her hard in the face with his fist. He ripped off her pink sweater and ordered her to remove her pants and underwear. Oddly, he performed oral sex on her, telling her to shut the fuck up and enjoy it.
That is just so weird.
Lala resisted him, and the two struggled, spilling the malt liquor all over the floor. Enraged, Tony grabbed the extension cord, and he wrapped it around Lala's neck. But she was able to put her fingers between her skin and the ligature, but that didn't help. She thrashed about. Large splinters from the old wooden floor gouged her body. But her fight was in vain. She struggled in and out of consciousness. She saw flashes of white light. And then everything went dark. The muscles controlling her bowels and urine relaxed, and she defecated and pissed on the floor. Tony, satisfied she's dead, grabbed the white plastic chair from the living room, and he placed it next to Lala's body, sat down, and spent the next 3 hours smoking crack, smoking cigarettes, and drinking.
What?
Just next to her body. Then he heard a gasp and watched in amazement as Lala tried to stand up. Her head was pounding, her neck burned, but she was grateful to be alive and determined to stay that way. And by that time, Tony's shit-faced, by the way.
Well, yeah, he's been smoking and drinking for 3 hours.
Lala grabbed the torn pink sweater from the floor, and it was just drenched with that malt liquor. As she slowly got dressed, Tony said to her, quote, "Where do you think you're going? You aren't leaving. I'm going to kill you."
Uh-oh.
But his words lacked passion, because I said, he is shit-faced. So Lala continued putting her shirt on, and she said to him, "I thought you were my friend, but look what you did to my sweater. You ripped my sweater." His voice became gentle, and he apologized to her. He asked her how much the shirt cost, and when she told him, he said, I'll give you $50 for a new sweater if you come back tomorrow.
What?
Okay.
Okay, sure.
She agreed. I'd be like, hell yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I had such
what
a
time
great...
do you want me to come back? I get up at 9.
She knew full well she wasn't coming back. As she tried to leave, Tony stopped her. He told her, you can't go home with a ripped sweater. And he gave her a shirt of his ex-girlfriend Lori's that she'd left behind in the house. After putting it on, Lala walked out the door, stunned by what just happened. As she kept walking a few houses down, Tony yelled out to her, I'll see you tomorrow, right? What an idiot asshole.
He must be high as fuck.
That night, Lala stayed at her friend's house. And when she woke up the next morning, she was in extreme pain. Her whole body hurt, especially her neck. Her friend took her to the university hospital, and that's when she told the nurses about the attack at Tony's house. She had all the telltale signs of someone who had survived a strangulation. There was a U-shaped furrow with the imprint of the electrical cord around her neck. Her fingernails were broken, and her fingers had the imprint of the cord also on them.
Wow.
That's how tight he had it. Her voice was raspy, and she had puncture wounds on her hips and legs from these large wood splinters. In addition, her face was bruised and swollen from being repeatedly punched by Tony. The police were given the name and address of Tony, but it wouldn't be another month before they secured a search warrant. Lala says they didn't act fast enough. They say they couldn't reach her for the answers they needed to get the warrant. Either way, a warrant wasn't issued until October 29th. A SWAT team made up of 30 men.
Jesus.
Maybe a few women. I don't know. I'm just saying men. Wearing helmets and bulletproof vests, stormed the house on Imperial Avenue. That's when Tony's house of horrors and the cause of the nasty smell that had been plaguing the area for 2 years was discovered. Using a 35-pound battering ram, they knocked down the door to the first floor apartment. That apartment is where Tony's stepmother had been living before she was placed in that nursing home. It was pristine. I saw pictures of it. You could tell the elderly woman took pride in her home and kept it up to date. And Tony apparently had never been in it in the years that she'd been gone. However, when they knocked down the door of the second level apartment, that looked quite a bit different. Just as Lala had stated, there was a dirty, tattered blanket and a ripped pink sweater and her feces still there on the floor.
It was all still there?
Yeah, a month later.
Damn.
Tony wasn't known for his cleanliness,
Tanya. Apparently.
But it was the third floor where the true extent of Tony's deprivation was presented. In the third floor, there was this cramped, filthy kitchen. It was filled with old food and dirty dishes. And as they walked through it, the smell of death grew stronger. The SWAT team went down the hallway, and there was this thin wooden door. When they tried to open it, it was locked. So they just busted it open with a battering ram. In the dark living room, which was what was behind the door, the stench became unbearable for the SWAT team. They could barely breathe. Pointing their flashlights around the room, two figures resembling bodies could be seen laying on the floor side by side each other. They were surrounded by cigarette butts, beer cans, and maggots. Gross. As they moved in for a closer inspection, the sound of maggots crunching under their shoes drowned out the buzzing of the flies that swarmed the windows.
Oh, I'm gonna throw up.
I know.
It's disgusting.
The windows were covered with garbage bags and a shovel lay against the wall. To the side was a mattress stained with what looked like blood, maybe feces. Both of the victims were decomposed beyond recognition. One of the victims, later identified as 31-year-old missing mother of three, Talicia Forston. And I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name. Everybody knows I'm horrible with names. Confirm, Tanya? I'm horrible.
Absolutely, yes.
Talicia was wearing a white skirt pulled up to her waist, and garbage bags were wrapped around her ankles.
Well, that's strange.
Talicia was adopted out of foster care at the age of 9 by a really loving woman. But her previous neglect and abuse, coupled with her issues at school as a result of her learning disabilities, caused her to turn to drugs as a teen. By the age of 14, she was running away and using lots of drugs. In June of 2009, so this is 4 months earlier, when Talicia failed to show up to braid her daughter's hair, her family feared the worst and filed a missing persons report. And now her body was found. Next to Talicia lay the body of 38-year-old Diane Turner, who went missing in September of 2009. So she was only missing about 6 weeks earlier. A cloth was knotted around her neck. She was naked. And a clump of hair and a steak knife were found next to her on the floor. Both Talicia and Diane were decayed to the point that they were unrecognizable. And DNA ended up having to be used to identify them. While some of the SWAT team was sent to search the third level, other very unlucky members were sent to the basement. In the area beneath the stairs, concrete had been chipped away and a mound of dirt was placed on top. A black garbage bag was protruding from the dirt, and the stench from it clearly indicated there was a rotting corpse buried there. Investigators just knew that they hadn't even scratched the surface of the evil secrets that this Imperial House held. But before I tell you more, I'm going to take a break. The Cleveland Police homicide detectives arrived, followed by the coroner, at about 8 p.m. The basement was a disgusting cesspool of filth and stench. On the floor in the basement was another dirty mattress surrounded by rat feces. Old buckets and women's clothing were scattered around. Eventually, crime scene specialists dug up the mound of dirt, and of course, they found a corpse. Nancy Cobbs lived a block away from Tony and spent most of her time doting on her grandchildren. She wasted a lot of her youth away on drugs, but as she got older, she calmed down. She used to sit with Tony on his porch after she got home from work and would drink a beer with him, and sometimes she would smoke crack. She was last seen on April 28th in 2009 and was later identified as the body under the stairwell. 3 days prior to Nancy's disappearance, a friend of hers named Tanya was attacked by Tony and barely made it out of the house alive. Tanya didn't call the police, but she did tell Nancy about it.
What the hell, Nancy?
Yeah, however, for whatever reason, Nancy must have still trusted Tony. Maybe they had a history, or maybe it was a crack calling her. But for whatever reason, she ended up going to Tony's.
Oh.
Her remains were found wrapped in duct tape from head to toe. And that takes a lot of time and effort.
What?
Her whole body was wrapped in duct tape like a mummy.
What the fuck?
She had a ligature made of rope and cloth tied around her neck, and her wrists were bound behind her back with twine. As investigators were searching the basement, one of them started examining the various buckets scattered around the floor.
Don't do it.
There was an old red one, and the rim had been chewed away by rodents. Dirt and debris partially covered a black plastic bag inside the bucket. Imagine the officer's surprise when he opened up the bag and found a skeletonized human skull in it.
It was just a head?
Just a head.
Oh my God.
The skull was later identified through DNA as 25-year-old LaShonda Long, who'd been missing since August of 2008. Although her head was found, they didn't know where the rest of her body was.
They never found it?
Spoiler alert, they never found it.
Oh my God.
Investigators believe the skull had been buried at some point and dug up and then placed in the bucket based on all the dirt around the skull. Did you know that when more than one body is found at a crime scene, the FBI can be called in for assistance?
I had no idea.
I didn't either. The Cleveland police wasted no time reaching out to them.
No, I wouldn't either. We need some help with this.
They showed up really quickly with specially trained cadaver dogs. The dogs immediately led their handlers to the third floor living room. Besides hitting on the bodies there, these dogs began scratching at one of the walls.
No.
Indicating a positive hit. Investigators cut out the drywall and found a hidden crawl space.
Oh, fuck.
There was this large black garbage bag filled and tightly tied, placed on top of a mound of dirt. Again, it had to have taken Tony a lot of time and energy to haul all of this heavy soil up three flights of stairs. Police removed the garbage bag and started digging the dirt with their bare hands. Their digging resulted in the discovery of 29-year-old Tashana Culver, wrapped in a comforter, then stuffed in some garbage bags and buried under dirt. She was nude, her wrists were bound behind her back, and a 4-foot-long piece of cloth was tied around her neck. Her hyoid bone was fractured. Tashana lived just a few houses down from Tony with her sister, and she vanished in June of 2008. She was a crack addict, but in high school, she graduated near the top of her class with all A's. A few years later, her boyfriend committed suicide, and she started self-medicating with weed, and then eventually started smoking crack, which is probably how she knew Tony.
Oh.
After the discovery of Tashana, one of the officers realized that the black bag that had been sitting on top of her grave also had a dead body in it.
Another one?
Another one. It was the body of Janice Webb. She was 48, and she was reported missing in June of 2009. Her family put up missing flyer posters, but noticed someone kept taking them down in the Imperial Avenue neighborhood. Janice was found with a green belt around her neck. Her shirt was tied around her face as a form of a gag, and her hands were bound in front of her with a shoelace. Although we don't know all the details of what happened to these women, later on in my story, we'll get a really good idea of what their last moments were probably like. The cadaver dogs were repeatedly led throughout the house over and over again just to make sure there were no more bodies. Investigators were prepared to rip this house down to the rafters if they had to. When they were convinced all the bodies inside the house had been located, they moved to the backyard. They only made it down the back porch steps when the dogs began scratching again.
Oh, my Lord.
The body of 52-year-old Tanya Carmichael was last seen November 10th of 2008, getting into her pickup truck and telling a friend she was going to go have some fun. She'd been buried. Her body was wrapped in clear plastic with a cell phone cord tied tightly around her neck. Tanya graduated from high school and attended community college, all the while supporting two young children. Eventually, she earned enough to buy her own house. But in 1997, she tried crack and became hooked.
That fucking crack. I swear it's ruined so many people.
I know.
It's just sad.
Crack is smack. She lost her job, her house got foreclosed on, and her kids got taken away.
Oh, that's so sad.
Her mother, a retired nurse named Barbara, tried to file a police report in December of 2008. According to Barbara, the police were aware of Tanya's drug use, and they refused to file it. Barbara says they told her Tanya will come home when the drugs run out.
It's really disgusting.
They deny that.
Of course.
But we're going to circle back to this
okay.
at the end of the story. Buried with Tanya were three small bags. The court records described them as manila folders, so I don't know. They were filled with mud and what appeared to be tiny fragments of human remains. The next day, backhoes and a dump truck were brought to the Imperial House, and police went full force in excavating the yard. A small team of officers using shovels and rakes found another mummified nude body early that morning. DNA would confirm that was Crystal Dozier, who went missing in May of 2007.
Wow.
She was buried in the ground with her hands tied above her head. A cloth was knotted around her neck and cable wires bound her ankles together. It was only 1 month after Crystal's death that the Cleveland Health Department got their first complaint about that awful smell.
Where was she buried?
In the backyard.
Hmm.
But who knows where her body was before
that? Right.
Trust me, as you'll soon find out, he wasn't all that concerned about rushing to bury bodies.
Oh, gross.
By the time Tony's backyard was fully excavated, four more bodies were unearthed, all too decomposed to identify the sex or the race. Various ligatures, such as belts, a shoelace, a shoulder strap from a briefcase, and cloth, remained around their necks. All of the victims, later determined to be women, were nude from the waist down, though some had their shirt or bra on. Eventually, DNA testing identified them, but it took up to 5 weeks before all of them were identified. One of the bodies was that of 47-year-old Imelda Hunter. She went missing on April 18th of 2009. She was the cousin of Crystal, and Imelda lived just down the street from Anthony.
All these neighbors are disappearing.
I know. Sometimes she would go to Tony's house and drink and smoke crack, and she referred to him as her buddy, telling her sister she thought he was a really nice guy.
Well, he probably was for a time being.
Her body was found nude with the shoulder strap of a briefcase or camera bag tied around her neck. She was wrapped in garbage bags and buried in the backyard. Another victim found in the backyard was identified as 43-year-old Kim Smith, nicknamed Candy. She disappeared on January 17th, 2009. That evening, she took her father out for some Chinese food, and she said she had to go to her boyfriend's house afterwards, but she obviously made a stop along the way. Kim had an amazing talent for singing. She graduated from high school and attended college studying music and art. But she developed a substance abuse problem, which is likely what brought her to Tony's house. Her body had been wrapped in plastic bags, her ankles and wrists were tied, and she was naked from the waist down. The last body to be identified was Michelle Mason. She lived in Tony's neighborhood.
Damn!
And disappeared on October 4th, 2008, as she was walking home. Her remains were found in a garbage bag wrapped in carpet padding in Tony's backyard. Cloth was tied around her neck, and that's all I know.
I mean, seriously, the police don't think it's weird that all these missing people are on the same block?
That is something we are going to address later.
Oh, good.
The police relied on a forensic entomologist named Joe Kuiper to estimate the approximate date of their deaths based on the insect activity on and around the bodies. As the bodies were removed from the scene, many of the neighbors were shocked. They'd known Tony as this friendly man. He was an ex-Marine who helped fix their leaking sinks and mowed the lawn for the older neighbors. One neighbor, her name was Debbie. She watched the body bags being loaded into an ambulance, and she assumed one of the bodies was Tony's, because the neighbors didn't know what was going on.
Right.
She drove to Tony's sister's house. Her name was Tressa. It was just a few blocks away. She was shocked to see Tony was there playing video games.
What?
Why his house was being investigated and bodies were being removed. Debbie told Tony that the police had found some dead bodies in his house. Tony looked at her, and in a calm voice, he said, quote, "It's all going to come out now. She made me do it," end quote. Realizing that Tony wasn't a victim, but probably a killer, Debbie drove back to her Imperial Avenue home and told her adult son about the conversation with Tony. He, in turn, went across the street and told the police. By the time the police made their way to Tressa's house, Tony was gone. I gotta give you some background on Tony, because this is gonna explain a lot of things. And you're gonna see that Tony has probably been a serial killer for decades. He was born in 1959 in a working class family. His mother, Claudia, worked as a dry cleaner press, and his father, Thomas, was an alcoholic who did construction. His father left his mother and her four other children when Tony was just a baby. Claudia fared well for a while. She worked a lot of hours. I mean, she was gone frequently, and her mother, her name was Irene Justice, lived with her to help her out. But Claudia reached her breaking point when Tony's older sister, Patricia, she was 17 years older than him, died of congenital heart failure, leaving behind five grandchildren for Claudia to raise.
Oh, man.
So she has like nine kids.
Ugh.
Both Claudia and her mother, Irene, who used a walker to get around, would beat the grandchildren for no reason. They would strip them naked, tie them to the stair rail, and whip them, all while 12-year-old Tony just stood and watched. These children were beaten so bad that as adults, they still have scar tissue on their body from it. But they weren't the only ones to feel the wrath of Claudia and Irene. One time, Tony didn't do his chores, and his mom was working. She found out somehow that he didn't do what he was supposed to do. He was tossing a ball in the front yard when Claudia pulled into the driveway. He went up to her to say hi, and she punched him in the face.
Oh, my God.
He cried, saying, "I think my nose is broken," and she told him, quote, "I don't give a fuck."
Oh.
Irene Justice, with her walker, would beat Tony, too.
That's just sad.
When he was 18, he enlisted in the Marines, and he was sent to Okinawa, Japan. There, he developed a taste for sex workers because he could abuse them and get away with it. He would sit them on a chair and strangle them till they were unconscious. He bragged about this to his fellow Marines. And most people believe that he didn't just strangle these sex workers to unconsciousness. He probably killed a few. Even his Marine friends said there were probably a few that died. It's likely his first murder occurred while over there. In fact, FBI profiler John Douglas said, and I'm going to quote, "I guarantee every place Tony lived, you're going to find cases of women just like these being raped and killed just like this." And he lived all over the world. He was in the Marines. He was in the Marines for 8 years. After 8 years of service, he was honorably discharged, and he moved back to Cleveland. Tony had a slew of minor arrests, you know, disorderly conduct and some domestic violence. But he eventually worked his way up to some serious felonies, which cost him 15 years of his freedom. And I got to tell you the story. In 1991, 21-year-old Melvette Sockwell's car broke down at about 6 a.m. on a Cleveland street. Tony offered her a ride to his home that he shared with his sister Tressa and her small kids, telling her, "You can use my phone." And she agreed. As he opened the front door, Melvette could see children's toys, and that put her mind at ease to enter the house. Everyone was still sleeping, so Tony told her to follow him quietly upstairs to the third floor. Once in his room, he immediately pulled out a large knife and he started raping her. She told him she's pregnant, which she was, and he didn't care. He rolled her over to anally rape her and ended up holding her hostage in his sister's home for 15 hours, all the while getting drunk on cheap booze. But eventually he grew tired. He told Mel that he was going to take a nap and then he was going to wake up and he was going to kill her. I don't know why he wouldn't just kill her first.
Right.
He tied her wrists with a necktie. He placed a belt around her ankles and he stuffed a rag in her mouth and put her on the bed next to him. Then he passed out. There was this open window in the room that led to the roof of the second floor. Seeing her chance, Melvette hopped over to the window and dived through it headfirst, landing partially on the gutter and the second floor roof. There were two elderly women talking across the street, and Melvette tried to get their attention by screaming, but she had that gag in. She was hopping up and down, naked. Then all of a sudden, someone jerked her bound wrists that were still tied behind her back and began pulling her inside the window. She was shocked when she turned around to see Tressa, Tony's sister.
What?
All the jumping had woke Tressa up, and she wasn't happy about it. If you think she's a sensitive woman, she's not. According to Malvette, Tressa hesitantly removed her bindings. All while Tony lay passed out only a few feet away from them on the bed. She's in the same room with them.
Oh my God.
Isn't that nuts?
Yes.
As Malvette was explaining to Tressa about her kidnapping and rape, Tressa said to her, well, if that's true, why didn't you just scream? And Malvette later explained, Tressa doesn't understand when you have a knife.
In your face?
In your face. You don't scream. By the grace of God, those two elderly women, they had noticed Malvette and they called the police. So the police showed up within minutes. Tony pled guilty to the charges against him and he got sentenced to 5 to 15 years in prison.
That's crazy.
Each time he was up for parole, Malvette showed up to make sure he served all his time. Prior to his release, he was evaluated to determine what risk, if any, he was to society. It's like a parole evaluation. The report indicated he had a low risk of reoffending with only about a 6% chance.
Are you kidding
me? I didn't even know you could put it in mathematical probabilities.
6%?
As a result, Tony would only have to check in with his parole officer once a year, and the neighborhood that he moved into didn't have to get notice that a sex offender had moved into the area.
That's unbelievable.
I know. After his release, Tony met Lori Frazier one night and they fell in love. He was totally head over heels with her and treated her like a queen at first. It was through Lori that he tried crack for the first time because he'd always been against crack. And once he tried it, he became hooked. Their relationship deteriorated and Lori left him after he tried to strangle her. It wasn't long after they broke up in 2007 that the smell began happening in the neighborhood and women began disappearing. So back to when all the bodies were found, Tony took off and the police couldn't locate him.
Hell yeah, he took off.
But on Halloween, 2 days after the bodies were unearthed, Tony was spotted walking down the street in the rain, and he was immediately arrested. He denied murdering the women. He could explain the 11 bodies found in his house.
Wasn't me.
No. But he did say that he had dreams about being what he called a punisher to bad women who smoke crack when they should be taking care of their families. But he said they were just dreams.
Uh-huh.
His bail was set at $6 million.
Jeez.
And as I wrote this, Tanya, I thought about something. What if there was some crazy ass rich man who decided to pay $6 million? Would Tony be, he'd be released.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that crazy?
Yes.
News of his arrest shocked the city of Cleveland. But there was one particular citizen who was enraged when she saw the reports on TV. 10 months earlier, 41-year-old Gladys Wade took the bus home around 5:30 after visiting a sister on the other side of town. She stopped to the Amira Imperial Beverage Store. It's a convenience store.
Mm-hmm.
It's next to the sausage company, so it's by Tony's. She bought some Molson Ice and a pack of Newport 100s. As she was walking home, Tony passed by her and said, "Merry Christmas. How about coming to my house and having a beer?" Gladys didn't know him, and she politely wished him a Merry Christmas as she walked away. But then, Tony grabbed her from behind, turned her around, and punched her in the face, knocking her out cold. A few seconds later, she regained consciousness and realized she was being dragged by the collar of her heavy winter coat up a cement driveway. She continued going in and out of consciousness as Tony dragged her body up the stairs. When Gladys came to, she realized she was laying on the floor next to a decorated Christmas tree in an unfamiliar home. Her coat and her top were off. She could feel blood on her face, and her back and legs ached from being dragged up the steps. She managed to get on her knees and started crawling to the nearest door, but it was locked. Instinctively, she screamed for help, and Tony came rushing through the door and started punching her in the face. He was yelling, "Scream all you want. No one will hear you. You better get ready to die. Now, bitch, take off your clothes." Gladys got up, and she took off running, but Tony knocked her down. When he'd entered the room, he'd opened that door. So Gladys ran to the landing, and together, her and Tony tumbled down a flight of steps, stopping on the second floor landing. Gladys rose up, struggling to keep her balance. In the darkness, she tried to escape, but ended up putting her hand through some glass in the second floor level door window. Tony, still on the ground, clutched her legs, and they tumbled down another flight of steps, landing in front of the front door. She reached for the door, but Tony grabbed her and threw her against the wall. He wrapped his hands around her neck tightly, looked her in the eye, and said, "I'm gonna kill you." But Gladys was smart. In a bid to save her life, she grabbed Tony's crotch, squeezing and twisting his testicles with all her might. And it worked. Tony released his grip on her, and she escaped through the front door.
Good for Gladys.
This is going to piss you off.
Oh, great.
There was a small gathering of men outside on the street and on the sidewalk, hanging around, doing whatever they're doing. Gladys ran up to them for help, shirtless, and her face is bloody. Her thumb is leaving a trail of blood through the yard. As she approached those men, Tony opened up the front door and yelled out, "Don't listen to this bitch. She tried to steal my watch." But Gladys was hysterical, and she was pleading with the men to help her. You know what they did?
They take her back to Tony?
They ignored her.
Of course they did.
And even made some lewd comments to her. Realizing that they were useless, Gladys ran across the street to this small pizza place called Bess's Pizza. She pled with the employees to call 911, but they refused. In fact, they yelled at her to get out of their shop because she was causing a mess on the floor with her blood.
That's crazy!
As she went to leave, Tony entered the pizza shop and threw her coat at her. Gladys bolted out the door, and she ran for what seemed like forever until she ended up spotting a cop car and pounding on the window. She was taken to the hospital and made a police report. A search warrant was issued. When police executed the warrant, they noticed the trail of blood and a bucket with broken glass that also contained Gladys's shirt. Tony was arrested on the spot. But shockingly, the detective assigned to the case, who was part of the sex crimes unit, she didn't feel Gladys's story was credible, so she didn't even look at the evidence collected during the seize.
You know how jaded you have to be?
I know.
She has probably seen some shit. Not that I'm defending her, but seriously.
Well, she dropped the ball.
She did drop the ball big time.
Because she never looked at the evidence, that meant the prosecutor never got the evidence. And in fact, she told the prosecutor she didn't believe Gladys. And as a result, Tony was released and the charges were dropped.
That's unbelievable. No, it's not unbelievable. But what the hell?
This would later come back to bite the Cleveland Police Department in the ass. And six more victims would die after the charges were dropped. Another survivor saw that Tony's face on the news. This woman had reported being raped in April of 2009 to the police, but nothing ever happened. Her assault was particularly brutal, but I don't have time to go into it because this episode's already going to be long. When she went to the police originally after the rape, they did a rape kit on her, but they never sent it out for processing. It stayed in the drawer of someone's desk. Had they done that, they would have saw that the DNA matched Tony and additional lives could have been saved. So Tony's arrested, he goes to trial, and another survivor named Vanessa Gay testified to a chilling tale of horror that's right out of a movie, Tanya. This is horrible. This happened to Vanessa in September of 2008. She was on Imperial Avenue looking for drugs when Tony, a stranger, approached her. He He told her it was his birthday and he didn't have anybody to celebrate with him and suggested she join him to go smoke some crack with him at his home. When she walked in, the house smelled like death. But Tony chalked it up to the spoiled chicken on the counter and the sausage company.
The poor sausage company.
I know, they're victim too. The next thing she knows, he's beating on her and ripping off her clothes, all the while ranting about crack hoes and bitches. After an hour or so of raping and violating Vanessa, Tony allowed her to go to the bathroom. She walked down the hallway and passed by his living room. In his living room, she could see this black tarp hanging from the ceiling all the way down to the floor. As she continued walking past, she could see there was a body wrapped in clear plastic and propped up in a sitting position behind the tarp. The body was missing its head.
No!
It was most likely the body of LaShonda Long, whose head was found in the bucket in the basement. Vanessa was held throughout the night, but the next morning when Tony woke up, he let her get dressed. I think his buzz wore off. As she was putting on her clothes, he said, "You're gonna tell, aren't you?" And she replied, "Tell what? You are a little rougher than what I'm used to, but what am I gonna tell?" Tony wrote down his number for her.
Stop it.
Walked her to the door and told her to come back on Friday when he gets paid so they could party some more.
All right.
Again, what time?
Yeah, what time?
Vanessa didn't end up reporting this to the police because she'd been raped a little over a year earlier and the man that raped her was acquitted. So she didn't have a lot of faith in the system. Anthony was found guilty and sentenced to death. However, he didn't die at the hands of the state, but of natural causes this year, on February 8th, the house on Imperial Avenue was razed and a memorial to the victims was put in its place. So I read this book. It's called House of Horrors, and it's written by Robert Spurna. And I can't recommend this book enough because there was so much more. There were so many more victims and things I could have put in this. So I absolutely recommend reading it. He interviewed Tony while Tony was on death row and said to Tony, "What would you say if someone asked why you did it?" Tony replied, and this is a quote, 4 words, "Abused children grow up."
Wow.
The city of Cleveland was sued by some of the victims' families, and the city paid $1 million in a settlement.
Each?
Total. LaTundra, Lala, Phillips, and Gladys also sued. Gladys received $40,000 and Lala received $260,000. Before I end this, I gotta share what happened with Lala. As you may recall, she grew up in a solid military family, and it was her report of abuse that eventually led to Tony's arrest. Since that time, Lala has turned her life around. She got a master's degree in social work at Cleveland State University in 2015. In looking back, she says, and this is a quote, "Drugs took away my problems and my feelings of inadequacy. I had to get high to ignore the realization that I wasn't a productive member of society or even my family. I'd lost everything. When I saw other women go to work, to the store, or taking care of their families, it hurt me. I was embarrassed at what I'd turned into. I wasn't raised to be a druggie or a thief. My kids would see me in the streets and they knew their mom was a crackhead and they were ashamed of me. It was insane for me to be in certain neighborhoods at 4 a.m, but my drug habit was so powerful that I rationalized my behavior."
Wow.
And on a final note, I researched and researched, but I could never find out what became of the 3 bags that had what is believed to be human remains in them.
Ugh. Wow, this story, I can't believe I didn't know more.
I know, it's all in the details, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So again, I want to thank Robert Spurna for the amazing book he wrote. I also got my information from some news articles, WCNC, Cleveland.com, CBS News, Daily Mail. I also know there's a documentary out there, but I didn't watch it. But there's a documentary out there. And that's it. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen to us today. If you like this episode and you want to get other episodes like this that are exclusive, we now have an Apple channel, Consequences X, for exclusive extras, ex-mazing episodes.
Ex-mazing.
You can also go to patreon.com/TNTCrimes and become a member. We have about 70 episodes there. We have Instagram and Facebook at Hardcore True Crime. And anything else?
Go to our website.
Go to our website, absolutely.
TNTCrimes.com. Well, until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.